All right, wonderful. Thank you very much. We've had a number of questions come in, and so I'm going to go ahead and run through a few questions for each of our presenters. I see we've got some extra slides here. Are these mostly for reference for our participants? So to all our participants, if you'd like to download the PowerPoint presentation, it is already posted on the AgriLinks event page for this event. And I'll ask one of our KDAD team members here to post the link to the event page to make sure that you all know where to pick up the PDF of this PowerPoint presentation. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and jump into some of the questions that have come through. One interesting one that might be most targeted to Amelia or Hope came in from Odipo Asano. To what extent is the soil variation attributed to natural differences, and to what extent could it be attributed actually to managerial differences in either Kenya or Tanzania? And also he tacked on which crops are most sensitive to the soil variations. But I think the crux is how much do managerial differences affect soil variability?
Amelia, do you want to take a crack at that or first?
Sure, I'm happy to give it a shot. I can't speak to Tanzania, but thanks, Julie. So this is Amelia talking. It really depends on which characteristics we look at. So certain soil characters, like the cation exchange capacity, are actually very, very difficult to alter and have much more to do with the soil type that you have. It's notoriously difficult to alter your CEC. For other things like pH and you know, all the limiting nutrients, of course, it varies a lot based on what types of fertilizers people have used in the past, and so managerial practices will matter a lot. And so basically the answer is both. In terms of which crops are most sensitive, I'm not an expert on this, so I will hope that somebody else is.
So I can add to the first part of the question. So that's something that we're really interested in, that we're trying to understand, actually. So we're pulling together data that includes management, and also, as I mentioned in the presentation, some of these, sort of easily available, observable characteristics, right? So like the slope, the soil texture and type, the sort of the altitude of the field. And what we're trying to do is to look at the variation within particular geographic areas and see, based on those kinds of observable, pretty immutable characteristics, you know, how much of the variation can we explain, right? So the assumption would not necessarily be that anything unexplained would be based on management, but, you know, a way to sort of start pulling out maybe how much of the variation could be explained locally based on some of those more structural characteristics. I will say, you know, we work really closely with soil scientists, and I gave a version of this presentation to a room full of soil scientists, which was terrifying, but interesting. And their general assessment was sort of conditional on soil type. A lot of it they think is management. I don't think I'm misstating what they said, but their assumption was, and this is actually due in large part to management. And, you know, when they say management, they're thinking broadly about that, you know, so based on, for example, just like years of continuous cultivation. Right, so how long has the field been in continuous cultivation? So I think it's a really important question, and it is one that we're trying to think about.
Great, thank you so much, Hope and Amelia. Hope, as long as you're on the line, another question had come in from you from Donald Greenberg. The financial return to increased fertilizer usage could be negative, even with farm-specific recommendations. Isn't that a more fundamental issue than the one-time effects of a voucher subsidy?
I mean, that's a great, great question. And, I think one thing that was missing from, our presentation, our analysis so far is thinking about those economic returns, right? So we've done some work on this and looking at, you know, what the effects are after a subsidy concludes on what people continue to do. I do think that that's pretty instructive because people are making choices about, you know, what looks profitable to them and where it seems sensible to deploy their investments once a subsidy is gone, but they may have learned about the input. But maybe I'll let Michael address that, given that he's got some research relevant to that topic.
Would you like me to jump in and say just a word on that?
Yeah, that would be fantastic if you're willing.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen several comments on subsidies because they really jump out across these studies as playing a role. So Pope was just referring to a study that we did in Mozambique where we followed farmers 2 years after a once-off voucher coupon, and sort of the part of the idea was that if fertilizers aren't really profitable, of course farmers will adopt them when the fertilizer is basically free or highly subsidized. But then once the subsidy goes away, you wouldn't imagine they would keep doing it. In the particular case of Mozambique, and I have to, since we're talking heterogeneity, I want to emphasize the particular case. This was in the central region of in Manica province in Mozambique. We actually found very strong and persistent effects, and that indeed individuals who received the voucher treatment continued to use much higher levels of fertilizer. And it was even the impacts of the program were even visible in roughly 10% increases in household living standards 2 years after the voucher coupon intervention had taken place. So, you know, I think it's a great question. I think Amelia showed us some information, was showing that, I think she was showing us net profitability numbers and was showing that if I understood her figure correctly, it was showing that for roughly half to two-thirds of the farmers, the fertilizers, the estimated returns actually were such that they would be profitable. But for the other 40% or whatever it was, probably not. So I don't know if Amelia, maybe you want to say a quick word on interpreting your results that you had in that sense.
Yeah, sure. I think, it depends a little bit on what characteristics you look at and so on. But yeah, I would say that overall, we find fairly low returns to fertilizer, actually, but that they do vary with characteristics. And I think there's certainly a proportion. I think you interpreted the figure correctly. For a portion of the sample, it looks like fertilizer is profitable. And this is for just 1 kilogram of nitrogen, right? So this is not speaking more broadly to perhaps other types of fertilizers. So as Hope discussed, it may be the case that certain other nutrients are more limiting, in which case just applying more nitrogen may not make that big of a difference. But there's certainly, I would say that our results support this idea that the type of fertilizer is going to matter for profitability. And to speak a little bit more broadly to the question of profitability, not only of subsidies, but of soil testing and all of those things. There's a trade-off there also temporally, right? If subsidies are such that you have to continue providing liquidity for farmers, then soil tests that provide farmers with better information about what types of nutrients they should apply could be more efficient, right? Because the farmers can keep that information. I'm sure you need to update the soil test at some point, but they may not need them sort of forever. They may just need one soil test every X years versus at least, you know, the government of Kenya is providing fairly frequent and continuous subsidies as are other African countries. So, I think there's definitely a lot to think about, and this is a really important discussion and a good question. So.
I guess one sort of final note on this is, in the context of our study, right, the dominant missing nutrient was sulfur, right? That was really important. And so, but the package that includes sulfur ammonium, is actually cheaper for farmers than the recommended package by the government, right? And so, you know, if you're thinking about the fact that if farmers are following the government recommendation, which granted in our Tanzania sample they weren't, you know, you could actually find some cost savings by recalibrating what the purchase is, you know, to better reflect what the specific nutrient deficiencies are of the farmer. So I think that's related to something that Amelia is suggesting.
Excellent. Thank you all for your responses and support to that question. A few questions came in during Caro's presentation as well, and one I thought was interesting from Jennifer Cisse. In the different contexts about which you spoke, Carolina, to what extent can the variation in yields be explained by soil heterogeneity in the absence of interventions? And perhaps another way of putting that is, what assumptions can we make about soil variability when we observe yield differences?
Thank you for the question, Jennifer. So I don't remember on the top of my head, but so when we run it, I think that, you know, soil differences in our first scenarios, we're explaining up to 15 variation in the yields, but don't take it for granted. I need to go back to look at that number. We run it like it was part of what was building the recommendations for us, but it was pretty high. Like it could explain, like it was very in line of what Amelia was saying with her CEC. And it's just like we not only use CEC, we're also using, like, you know, organic matter, and we also were using, like, things that Hope was saying. Like, for example, the slope is super important. We are working in a mountainous region, also was super important. So, and we could explain a lot of the yield variation. So going back to the questions that we had before, if that is true, then it's actually more supportive of the idea of understanding new fertilizers recommendation better. So life is not only about urea. No, so yes, no plant can survive without nitrogen, but when we are talking about changes in yields, we need to start talking about other inputs. And especially in Mexico, it was through the micronutrients, especially boron and zinc, if I don't remember it correctly, they were explaining a lot of the variation in yield. So, and that's when we need to start talking more with the agronomists. I don't know if I answered your question, sorry.
No, thank you very much. Going back to Amelia, there was some discussion about what farmers know and what farmers are communicating to each other about soil variability. So a question came in, how aware are farmers of local differences within the soil? And do they have a sense of whose soils are similar to theirs and whose are different? It may actually not be that helpful to share information between farmers if there really is a ton of variability between different farmers' fields. So in other words, could you dig into that a little bit more about how variability really affects spillover communication and you know, explain a little bit more about what farmers really do know about their own fields?
Yeah, certainly. So that's a great question, and I love it. I find this fascinating. So it's my sense that farmers are quite aware of these differences. So in a social network study, I look specifically at sort of farmers' communications about a randomly introduced new technology and find that the extent to which they're sort of willing to learn from other people's experiences varies with the amount of heterogeneity in that village, the soil quality heterogeneity, okay? So that just first off sort of suggests that they're quite aware of the type of the amount, at least, of variability. Other things to support that are that as part of the social network study, I collected data on whose soils they think are most similar to theirs, and I have yet to dig into, I'm trying to think of a good way to measure it, actually, but to think about exactly, you know, how to use their answer to that question. But interestingly, in villages where there was more soil quality heterogeneity, farmers mentioned fewer other farmers as having similar soils to theirs, okay? And so that is, it's still just suggestive, but it does suggest that farmers have some awareness of whose soils are similar to theirs. Furthermore, we asked several questions about sort of observables, you know, what type of soil do you have, how fertile is it, et cetera, a few different questions. And we can explain quite a lot of the variability in some soil characteristics, especially things that are that change less over time. So CEC, that's one of the reasons I like it as a measure, is because it stays fairly constant and is doesn't change in response to management practices. And so we can explain a lot, like almost 60% of the variation in measured cation exchange capacity with three or four different farmer stated questions about their soils. So that to me suggests that it's not a perfect prediction, of course, but it suggests that there's quite a lot of local knowledge about these issues. And so it does also suggest that if we wanted to sort of spread information via social networks, we should really only be trying to do that in places where people are similar enough to each other, because otherwise either we'll spread the wrong information because the median farmer recommendation is not appropriate for others, or we won't spread anything at all because we're trying to get a bigger bang for our buck, but we really, you know, farmers just won't learn anything from that information because they don't believe it, because they know that their soils are different. So, great question.
Thank you so much. And as long as I have you on the line, there was a quick clarifying question that came in from Dick Tinsley. How readily is fertilizer in Tanzania and Kenya available? Do farmers have to get any extension approval to obtain fertilizer? He was just wondering if there are any barriers in terms of approval.
There aren't any barriers, at least not in Kenya. You can buy it. And in fact, I have a team in the field right now doing surveys with agri-dealers and everyone in local areas who sell fertilizer. And during peak season, you can even obtain fertilizer at the supermarket and at the hardware store and just about everywhere, which is terrible fertilizer survey because it's a lot more observations, a lot more people to interview than I thought, but it's super interesting. So the difference is, I mean, there may not be high-quality fertilizer, there may not be the type of fertilizer or the manufacturer that you want, so there's, or as Caro mentioned, the appropriate micronutrients may not be in the fertilizer, and so there's a lot of different limitations, but just strictly speaking, getting fertilizer is easy if you have the money.
Very good to know.
This is Hope.
Go ahead, Hope.
I can chime in on that. Yeah, it's a little bit different, I think, in Tanzania, and there's, I think, two dimensions to think about that are important. So one is, you know, we had that, it's like a gradient of nutrient limitations for the farmers, right? So if you need just nitrogen, you can get that almost anywhere. You know, even in Tanzania, which has a, I think, less sophisticated, less developed market system for inputs than Kenya, you know, we just completed a big study and, you know, in the tertiary markets year-round, you can get urea and NPK. Once you start needing things like sulfur blends for fertilizer, it looks like you have to go to the closest sort of regional capital maybe to get that. So you'd have to go to Morogoro or Ifakara. If you need something that's going to address like an NPKS limitation, then you're going to have to figure out how to get that from DAR, right? So the complexity of the blend is definitely, harder to fill the further out you get in the rural area, at least in Morogoro. And then the second dimension of this, which Amelia just alluded to, and she and I both have research on ongoing on this, is the quality of the fertilizer which is available in markets, right? So there's some very interesting and I think extremely important questions about how good the fertilizer is that's available in those markets, right? So whether or not it actually has the nutrient content that it's supposed to have based on the manufacturing standard. Amelia and I are both doing work to assess that and to try to understand, you know, where are the failures of these systems happening, these marketing systems happening, and, you know, why are we seeing these kinds of poor quality inputs in markets? Because we do see that there's a lot of missing nitrogen, for example, in the fertilizer that's being sold in markets. So I think thinking about the complexity of the blend and the quality of what you can get is really critical, you know, not just thinking about, you know, where you can actually, you can get an input.
Great, thank you.
Just one thing to ask there, Hope.
Go ahead, Carol.
Can I add something more? Yes, so now that we're working, like, for Fight in Kenya, like, I can tell you for the last two seasons, one of the things that we observed is true that fertilizers are, we are expecting for them to be available, but we were tracking the on bi-weekly basis, the stock of the agrobets that were working for us because we had a coupon to measure adoption. And actually, we saw a lot of fluctuations. Like, for example, agrobets, they might run out of fertilizer for maybe 4 or 5 days. And that happens on a regular basis. So, and because you're interested also in quality, so when farmers, they cannot buy it at the agrobet because it's just run out, they will go with the vendors at the market. So vendors are like a small stall, a person with a bio fertilizer. And the way they were like handling the fertilizer, actually the bags of nitrogen were remaining open for very long hours. So it is expected that even if the quality, let's assume the quality of the fertilizer was high at when it went out of the factory, the way that these fertilizers are handling, you're expected that the amount of nitrogen there, like they could be low, very, very low. The other product that actually we had to, because we are working with soil acidity in Kenya, so and we were trying farmers to adopt agricultural lime, we had to do all the distributions on a stock by agrobets because it's a product that is not there. And the reason why the product is not there is not because it's expensive, actually it's because it's too cheap and the cost of transport is very high. But it could have like important implications in your nutrient balance, because actually helps your absorption of phosphorus. So, sorry, those two comments.
Great, thank you. And as you can all see, we have a few polls on our screen. We ask that you fill those out to help us understand how this webinar benefited you and help us plan for future webinars. So thank you in advance for filling out our polls. We have about 5 minutes left for questions, so I'm hoping to squeeze a few more in. One question came in from Timothy Russell, perhaps most oriented towards Hope's presentation. The soil testing kit looks interesting, but how close are we to having precision ag technology based perhaps on remote sensing for mapping soil fertility variation in Africa? And can high-definition satellite technology be used to help determine variability? Do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, I can say a little bit. I think that's a fantastic question. You know, the other thing that people have been talking about, especially so here at the University of Illinois, there's a number of folks in the crop sciences department that are trying to do remote sensing-based measures of yield. And so they're kind of backing into these questions of soil quality because they're trying to think about, you know, predicting yields, basically, right? And they're trying to do that for smallholder agriculture in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, which is a hard problem. So, you know, they're thinking about that question. And one thing that they've gotten excited about, and this could just be like a form of technological utopianism where it could have some real possibilities, I'm not really sure yet, but is using drones to gather data, you know, that would be a bit more have a finer geographic scale, I suppose, than sort of some of the broader satellite measures that you can currently get. And so you might end up filling in this sort of meso level that we're missing between the field level or the village level test and, you know, and the satellite measure. So one thing that we're doing is we're actually taking our measures that we have at the field level and we're trying to see how they correspond to existing publicly available data that's based on remote sensing data, right? And the correspondence is not great at this point. And that's for a number of different reasons. And so I would say at this point, I think we would need some additional kinds of input to improve the precision of the sort of remotely based precision tools that are available, if that makes any sense. But I'm sure that's going to improve.
Yeah, this is Michael Carter, and I just to chime in on that, we've just started working with very high resolution imagery that we got from Planet Labs. So it's roughly, I think it's 2 meter by 2 meter resolution from their sort of fleet of little satellites. And it's definitely possible to pick up nutrient deficiencies in growing plants. We had not yet thought about tracing that down to the underlying soil. I guess you probably could do that, especially in areas where management is not particularly interfering, at least in the short term. So we've been using it for yield prediction, but I think you could also, more in the spirit of precision agriculture, you know, you can certainly pick up nutrient deficiencies. So obviously it would depend on the soil and then what management practices are being thing. But I like what you're suggesting, Hope, but you should look into this. It's Planet Labs did have an agreement with USAID, and they also have an academic wing, which they will make some of this 2 meter by 2 meter imagery available for academic research purposes, and they seem quite happy to be helpful when it comes to working on sub-Saharan Africa.
Great, that's really exciting, actually.
And lastly, Michael, I know you wanted to quickly touch on, taking into account the fact that vouchers played a major role in take-up, or seemed to. Is there a sense of whether this is due to liquidity constraints versus a fear of the risks associated with the unknown?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And this, I briefly mentioned this project in Mozambique. And we had actually combined the voucher intervention, which again was just a short-term thing, and someone from Miramar had chimed in about that being a good way to do it. They're looking at it there, and I agree with that point. But we also matched it with a savings intervention, so people had better access to safe savings with positive rates of return. And we thought those two interventions would be complementary. And what we actually see is that farmers that got both the voucher coupon and the access to improved savings, actually after the dust settled and they were, you know, moving forward with what they had learned from the interventions, farmers that got both things actually saved a lot of money. And farmers that only got the voucher interventions were investing more of their money in fertilizers, but were actually, as I mentioned before, they had a higher mean consumption, but not surprisingly, they made their consumption more variable. And the farmers that were given a good savings tool, which is a way to self-insure yourself, invested some in fertilizer, but much more so in kind of self-insurance. So I think in the end, what I take away from that full range of that study is that in response to the question, I think it's exactly right. I think vouchers are partly taking away some risk, at least temporarily, but if we really want people to sustain it, a lot of farmers are dealing with very large amounts of uninsured risk. And I guess to make my final comment, I sort of suggested at the beginning, you know, why this sort of African exceptionalism. These soil issues may be one. Another one may be the heavy dependence on rain-fed and highly variable rain-fed agriculture and highly variable rain. And so maybe it's the combination of these things which perhaps explain the low uptake of some of these technologies, which at least in some places appear to be profitable.
Thank you, Michael. All right, I think we are out of time for our webinar today. We'd like to end as close to on time as we can. But thank you so much to everyone who participated today. We really appreciated the excellent questions, comments, and resources that you all shared in the chat box. We really appreciate that. The AgriLinks webinars are really about the participants, so thank you very much for joining us today. And of course, thank you also to our excellent presenters from the Feed the Future Innovation Lab for Assets and Market Access. We are really excited to be able to share this new research on soils and soil variability, and we look forward to much more from you all in the next couple of months. I'm interested to see everything that you share. And also thank you very much to the KDAD and AgriLinks teams who put on these webinars for us every month. So we hope to see all of you back for future AgriLinks webinars. And I think that will complete our event for today. So thank you very much. We'll send out via email the recording and other resources from this event. So keep your eyes open for that. Thank you very much.